All right, so we're diving into some really interesting stuff today. Trademark law can get pretty complex, and this case we're looking at, the Winnoralco v. Thomas case, really brings some of those complexities to the forefront, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. I mean, at its heart, this whole thing is about how courts figure out if one business's name or logo is too close for comfort to another's, to the point where it might actually confuse customers. And the case itself revolves around two car wash businesses, both using the name Classic Car Wash, so it's pretty relatable, something that could happen in any industry, really.
So we've got court documents, legal briefs, all that good stuff to help us unpack this. And what I'm really hoping we can do today is pull out those crucial insights, especially for anyone out there, thinking about the real-world implications of trademark law. How does this stuff actually play out in practice? Because that's what really matters, right?
Absolutely. And this case is a fantastic example to learn from because it went all the way up to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. So we get to see how the higher courts really grapple with these issues.
Okay, so let's start with the basics just to set the stage. We've got Winn Oil Company. They had the trademark Classic for car care products, think like car wax and stuff back in 1975. And then they registered Classic Car Wash for services starting in 1983.
But here's a twist, right? Winn Oil, they didn't actually operate any car washes themselves. They were licensing out the Classic Car Wash name to other businesses.
Interesting. So they had the name, but they weren't the ones actually washing the cars. Okay, got it. Now, on the other side, we've got Michael Thomas, who started his own chain of car washes, six locations in Tennessee, all using either Classic Car Wash or sometimes Classic Car Wash systems. And he started those a few years earlier, back in 1980. So we've got some overlap in timing there, which is probably where things start to get messy, right?
Exactly. That overlap in timing, plus the obviously similar names, that's what sparked this whole legal battle. Winn Oil essentially said, "Hold on, you can't use Classic Car Wash. That's infringing on our trademark, plain and simple." They argue that customers would likely get confused, thinking that Thomas's car washes were somehow connected to Winn or endorsed by them. Like maybe they're using Winn's car care products or something.
Right, makes sense. So, what happened initially? Did Winn Oil just automatically win the case?
Actually, no. The first round, the district court actually sided with Thomas. They didn't see enough evidence to support Wynn's claim of trademark infringement.
Oh, wow. So, it wasn't a slam dunk for Wynn at all.
Not at all. But Wynn, they weren't satisfied with that decision, so they appealed it to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that's where things really get interesting, because the Sixth Circuit reversed the lower court's ruling and sided with Wynn.
Okay, so that means the Sixth Circuit saw things differently. But why? What was it about their analysis that led them to a different conclusion? What were they looking at that the district court maybe missed?
Well, to understand that, we have to dive into the heart of trademark infringement law. The legal concept that really drives these cases, and that's the likelihood of confusion standard under the Lanham Act.
Okay, the likelihood of confusion. So break that down for us. What does that actually mean in practical terms? How do you measure confusion?
So imagine you're a customer walking down the street and you see two businesses with similar names. The question is, are you likely to get them mixed up? Would you think they're the same company, or that one is somehow related to the other? Maybe one endorses the other's products. That's the kind of confusion we're talking about. It's not just about whether the names are identical, but whether they create a misleading impression in the mind of the average consumer.
Oh, I see. So it's about that overall impression, the perception that someone might have. It's not just a purely objective side-by-side comparison of the names or logos.
Exactly. It's about how people actually experience the marketplace.
Yeah.
And to really analyze this likelihood of confusion, the courts have developed a set of factors, sort of like a checklist to guide their analysis.
Okay, a checklist, so it's not just a free-for-all where the judge just decides based on their gut feeling.
Right. There's a framework to help ensure consistency and fairness. And in this case, the Sixth Circuit relied on a specific eight-factor test, which originally came out of a case called Frisch's Restaurants v. LB's Big Boy. These factors help the court systematically evaluate all the different aspects of the situation and ultimately determine whether there's a likelihood of confusion.
All right, eight factors. Let's hear them. What are we talking about here?
So the first factor is the strength of the plaintiff's mark, meaning how distinctive and recognizable it is. The second is the relatedness of the goods or services offered by both parties. Are they in the same market? Do they target similar customers? Third, we look at the similarity of the marks themselves. How close are the names or logos? Fourth, is there any evidence of actual confusion? Have customers actually been mixed up? Fifth, we consider the marketing channels used by each party. Sixth, the degree of care that consumers exercise when purchasing those goods or services. Like, are they likely to do a lot of research before buying, or is it a more impulsive purchase? Seventh, the defendant's intent when they chose their mark. Did they intentionally try to copy the plaintiff? And finally, the eighth factor is the likelihood that either party will expand their product or service lines in the future.
Wow. Okay. That's quite a list. It sounds like the court really tries to look at this from every angle. So do all eight of those factors have to point towards confusion for a court to find infringement?
That's a great question. And it's a common misconception. It's not like a scorecard where you need to tick all eight boxes. Instead, the court weighs all the evidence presented under each factor. They consider the totality of the circumstances. So even if some factors suggest confusion is unlikely, infringement can still be found if the overall picture points in that direction. And the Wood v. Thomas case, it's a perfect illustration of this balancing act.
Okay, I'm starting to get it. So let's break down some of these key factors, specifically in the Wood v. Thomas case, just to see how this all played out. First up, the strength of the mark. How strong was Wynn's classic trademark?
The court categorized classic as a suggestive mark, which actually puts it in a pretty good position legally.
Suggestive. So what does that mean?
It means the mark hints at a quality or characteristic of the product without directly describing it, like copper tone for suntan lotion. It suggests you'll get a tan, but it doesn't literally say tanning lotion on the bottle.
Right, right. So it's more subtle. It implies something about the product without spelling it out.
Exactly. And suggestive marks, they get a good amount of legal protection because they're distinctive, they stand out, they're not just generic or descriptive, like calling a car wash the car wash.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't get any protection.
Oh, I see, I see. So classic suggests something positive about the car care products, maybe like a timeless appeal or high quality without just saying good car wax.
Exactly. And what really strengthened Wynn's position was that they had federally registered the classic trademark. That registration creates a presumption that the mark is valid and enforceable. So the burden shifted to Thomas to try and prove that the mark wasn't valid, which is a much tougher argument to make.
So that registration really tips the scales in Wynn's favor. Okay, makes sense. Now let's move on to relatedness of goods or services. On the surface, you know, selling car wax and running a car wash, they seem like different businesses, right?
Right, and that's what the district court initially thought. They took a pretty narrow view, focusing on the specific products and services. But the Sixth Circuit, they look at it differently. They said, okay, sure, one company is selling car wax and the other is washing cars, but ultimately they're both serving the same basic consumer need, the desire for a clean car.
Ah, so they zoomed out and looked at the bigger picture, the overall market, and how consumers perceive these businesses.
Exactly. It's not just about the literal products or services, but the overall impression and the potential for confusion in the marketplace.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, the similarity of the marks themselves, that one seems pretty straightforward, right? They were both using classic car wash or something very close to it.
Yeah, that one was pretty clear-cut. The court found the marks to be very similar, almost identical. Thomas was using classic car wash and classic car wash systems, so there wasn't much wiggle room there.
Okay, now, here's where things get a little tricky for me. Evidence of actual confusion. I read that there was no actual evidence presented of customers getting mixed up between Wynn and Thomas. So if nobody was actually confused, how could the court still rule against Thomas?
That's a really important point, and it's something that often trips people up. You see, while evidence of actual confusion is very persuasive, it's not technically required to prove trademark infringement.
So even if no one has actually been confused yet, the court can still step in and say, nope, this is too risky. We need to stop this.
Precisely. Trademark law, it's designed to be proactive. It's about protecting trademark rights and preventing consumer confusion before it becomes a widespread problem. You know, if you wait until there's tons of evidence of people being confused, well, by then, the damage might already be done.
Oh, okay, I see. It's like better safe than sorry.
Exactly. And in this case, the court looked at the strength of Wynn's mark, the relatedness of the services, the near identical names, and they said, look, even if we don't have documented instances of confusion, the potential for it is so high, we need to step in and prevent it.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense now. What about Thomas's intentions when he chose the name Classic Car Wash? Did the court care about whether he did it on purpose or if it was just an honest mistake?
Well, the court did note that there wasn't any strong evidence to suggest that Thomas deliberately set out to copy Wynn or to capitalize on the reputation. You know, it wasn't like a clear-cut case of bad faith.
So it seems like he might have just picked the name innocently without realizing it was a problem.
It's possible. But here's the thing. Even if Thomas was completely innocent, even if he had no intention of infringing, that doesn't automatically get him off the hook. You know, intent isn't the deciding factor in trademark infringement cases. The focus is always on that likelihood of confusion, regardless of the defendant's state of mind.
Okay, so even with good intentions, you can still find yourself on the wrong side of trademark law. That's a good reminder for anyone starting a business. Now, there was also mention of this concept of incontestability in the materials. What's that all about? Sounds pretty serious.
Yeah, incontestability, that's like the holy grail of trademark protection. It's a special status that a federally registered trademark can achieve after 5 years of continuous use. Basically, it makes the trademarks much stronger and harder to challenge.
So it's like once you hit that five-year mark, your trademark becomes almost invincible.
Pretty much. Once a mark becomes incontestable, you can't challenge it on certain grounds anymore. Like, you can't argue that it's merely descriptive or that someone else used it first in a different geographic area. It really limits the defenses that someone can raise against your trademark.
Wow, that's a huge advantage. So in this case, Wynn's classic mark for car care products, it became incontestable in 1980. And that's why Thomas couldn't effectively argue that he'd been using Classic Car Wash since 1980, right? Even though he started using it before Wynn registered Classic Car Wash, specifically for services, that earlier incontestability for the classic mark for car care products basically shut down that argument.
Exactly. It shows the power of federal trademark registration and maintaining that incontestable status. It's a really important strategic move for any business.
Absolutely. Now, there's another interesting element to this case. The USPTO, the US Patent and Trademark Office, they actually had already rejected Thomas's application to register classic car wash systems.
Yeah, that's a key detail. The USPTO, they're the ones who grant trademarks in the first place, and they saw a problem with Thomas's application. They said it was likely to cause confusion with Wynn's existing classic trademarks.
So even the trademark experts saw a red flag there.
Right. And while courts aren't bound by the USPTO's decisions, they often give them a lot of weight because, you know, the USPTO are the specialists in this area. So that rejection was another sign that Thomas's use of classic car wash was probably going to run into trouble.
Okay, so in the end, Wynn won the appeal. What happened to Thomas? Did he have to pay a bunch of money in damages?
Interestingly, no. The court only ordered injunctive relief, which basically means they told Thomas to stop using the infringing names. He had to stop using classic car wash and classic car wash systems.
So no financial penalties.
Right. Wynn didn't provide enough evidence to show that they had suffered actual financial harm because of Thomas's actions. So this case shows that trademark infringement cases can have different outcomes. Sometimes the main goal is just to stop the infringing behavior, and sometimes it's also about getting compensated for damages.
Okay, so let's wrap things up. You know, we've covered a lot of ground here, but what are the big takeaways, the key lessons from the Wynn v. Thomas case? Especially for our listeners out there, you know, the future legal eagles who are really trying to get a handle on trademark law.
Well, this case is a really clear reminder that the strength of your trademark, combined with how related the goods or services are, can be enough to win a trademark infringement case, even without proof of actual confusion or bad intent.
Right. So it's not just about whether someone is intentionally trying to copy you. It's about that broader potential for confusion in the marketplace.
Exactly. And this case also highlights the importance of federal trademark registration. You know, getting that registration and achieving incontestability, those are really powerful tools for protecting your brand.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier this idea of de novo review. Why is that important for understanding how appellate courts work?
De novo review. It basically means that the appellate court, in this case the Sixth Circuit, looked at the likelihood of confusion issue completely fresh. They didn't just defer to what the lower court decided. They made their own independent judgment based on the evidence.
So they weren't just looking for procedural errors. They were actually reevaluating the core issue itself.
Exactly. And that's why you can sometimes see different outcomes at different levels of the court system. You know, one court might see things one way and a higher court might see them differently.
Right. So it's not always a straight line in legal cases. Okay. So let's say there's a local coffee shop and they call themselves Starbean. you know, kind of sounds familiar, right? And then the big Starbucks chain decides to open a location right across the street. Even if there's no evidence of customers actually walking into the wrong place, could Starbucks still argue trademark infringement?
Absolutely. You know, even though they're both coffee shops and they're right next to each other, Starbucks could still say, hey, this name is way too similar and it's likely to confuse people. And the strength of the Starbucks brand, that would be a major factor in their favor.
Yeah.
It's very similar to the core principles we saw in Wynn v. Thomas.
So even if you're a small business, you really need to be careful about choosing a name that's too close to a big established brand.
Right, right. It's all about understanding those trademark principles and mitigating your risk.
So what does this all mean for you, our listeners? This deep dive into the Wynn v. Thomas case, it really shows how tricky trademark law can be and how important it is to protect your brand identity. Choosing a business name, it's not just about being creative. It's about understanding the legal landscape and avoiding potential conflicts. And the fact that the court found infringement in this case, even without clear evidence of actual confusion, that really highlights the proactive nature of trademark law. You know, it's about preventing problems before they even start.
Exactly. And for you, as future legal professionals, this case is a great example of how the likelihood of confusion standard is applied in practice. You know, you see how the courts weigh those different factors, the strength of the mark, the relatedness of the services, all of that.
Yeah.
It's a real-world lesson in trademark law.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're ever unsure about whether a name or a logo might be infringing, it's always best to consult with a trademark attorney. You know, they can help you navigate those complexities and protect your business.
Couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, that's been a fascinating deep dive into Wynn v. Thomas. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next time for another deep dive into the world of law.
See you then.